Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th canto, chapter 14, King Chitraketu's Lamentation, text 17. Angira uvacha abhite namayam swasti abhiti nam tatatmana itha prakriti virgupta uman raja chasaptabhi. The great sage Angira said, "My dear king, I hope that your body and mind and your royal associates and paraphernalia are all well." When the seven properties of material nature, the total material energy, the ego, and the five objects of sense gratification, are in proper order, the living entity within the material elements is happy. Without these seven elements, one cannot exist. Similarly, a king is always protected by seven elements: his instructor, Swami or Guru, his ministers, his kingdom, his fort, his treasury, his royal order, and his friends. Purport. As it is quoted by Sridhara Swami in his Bhagavatam commentary, Swamyamatyo Janadapa Janapada Durga Javena Sanchaya Dando Mitram Tatasyaita Sabda Prakritayo Mata. A king is not alone. He first has his spiritual master, the supreme guide. Then come his ministers, his kingdom, his fortifications, his treasury, his system of law and order, and his friends or allies. If these seven are properly maintained, the king is happy. Similarly, as explained in Bhagavad Gita, Dehino Smin Yatha Dehe, the living entity, the soul, is within the material covering of the Mahasthapa, ego, and Panchatam Matra, the five objects of sense gratification. When these seven are in proper order, the living entity is in a mood of pleasure. Generally, when the associates of the king are quiet and obedient, the king can be happy. Therefore, the great sage Angira Rishi inquired about the king's personal health and the good fortune of his seven associates. When we inquire from a friend whether everything is well, we are concerned not only with his personal self, but also with his family, his source of income, and his assistants or servants. All of them must be well, and then a person can be happy. Om Ajnanachirmanandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurmanitamina Tazamaya Shri Guru Vayama Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Srivasari Govakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yesterday we spoke about the king who had everything. Well, almost everything, because that is the way of material existence. You can never be completely satisfied in the Bhava Sindhu, the ocean of becoming and unbecoming. That is the material world. There's always a gap. There's always some fault. There's always something that's just not right. Of course, the usual way that we handle such gaps, such voids, the something missing, the usual way is to become frustrated and blame someone. It's all your fault. I have this gap. I have this hole in my life. Indeed, it can be said about material existence that everyone needs someone to blame. They claim everyone needs someone to love. That is true, because the living entity has the loving propensity, because originally you are in relationship with Krishna in exchange of pure love. But the mistake is you try to satisfy your loving propensity in the material world. So yes, everyone needs someone to love, but also an essential ingredient of material life is that everyone needs someone to blame. So your quest in life, materially speaking, is indeed to find someone to love and to find someone to blame, and often the two are the same person. Chichiketu had the world. He had beautiful wives. He was handsome, well-educated. He had everything five-star, except one thing. He didn't have a son. And having a son was crucial to him. You may say, well, it wouldn't be a big deal for me or you. Why is he so hung up? I mean, look what he's got. He should take inventory of what he has. Amazing. We read the list yesterday. He was endowed with a beautiful form, magnanimity, and youth. He was born in a high family. He had a complete education, and he was wealthy and opulent. What can you want? However, he was full of anxiety because he didn't have a son. So you may say, that wouldn't be any big deal for you, but you're not the king with the king's karmic background and his particular blend of desires. So this section of Bhagavatam certainly teaches you how to have empathy, how to walk a few kilometers in someone else's shoes. As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, the true yogi sees the equality of all beings, regardless of their external trappings of happiness and distress. The true yogi understands that the accumulated karmic reactions known as happiness and distress are external to the living entity. Therefore, the true yogi is not bewildered by thinking, oh, this one is happy, this one is distressed. The true yogi sees that the spirit soul is equal in all circumstances. Amidst the king's crisis, and it was a crisis, Angira Rishi appears. Crisis is a great opportunity for going to a higher level. Even material analysts recognize that. One, at the beginning of the global financial crisis in 2008, one famous Stanford economist coined the expression that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Meaning, when a crisis hits, you can really shake things up, make changes, push things through that ordinarily would take a long time to push through. So a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, you see Arjuna in crisis. He's having what is known in contemporary analysis as a complete breakdown, a psychological breakdown. He has all the symptoms there of a breakdown. He's in a crisis. I don't see any way out, Krishna. All our options are bleak. Since all the options we have are bleak, I might as well just forget it all. Just walk away. What do? Conquer them or be conquered by them? Each option is unattractive. So this is the entrance into depression. You don't see any way that you can further your ambitions. All the roads are blocked. You may have had experience of being caught in a massive traffic jam and you just couldn't get out of it. Well, we'll try a side road. We'll detour this way, that way. But nothing works. Everything is blocked. You're stuck. It's a very frustrated feeling of helplessness. So Arjuna was in a crisis, and in his crisis, he approached Krishna, Karpanya Dosha Patasvabhava. I'm confused, I'm bewildered about my duty. I don't know what's good for me. In these circumstances, I'm approaching you as your disciple. Friendly talks are over, as Prabhupada would always say when quoting that verse. Friendly talks have ceased. Now, you please instruct me, I am your dependent. I'm dependent on you for providing the light for me to make my way out of this darkness. Angira Rishi is going to instruct Chittaketu. Chittaketu approaches him properly. Shukadeva Goswami describes, O King Prithit, when Chittaketu, bent low in humility, was seated at the lotus feet of the great sage, the sage congratulated him for his humility and hospitality. The sage addressed him in the following words. So Chittaketu set up the scene perfectly to receive transcendental knowledge. As soon as Angira Rishi appeared, Chittaketu stood up from his throne. He offered him worship, puja. He offered drinking water, eatables. Seated him very comfortably. And then, Shukadeva Goswami describes, the king, restraining his mind and senses, sat on the ground at the side of the Rishi's feet. So this is symptomatic of someone who wants to make advancement. He is not thinking that, well, I am the king, the master of practicality. He is a religious person. He'll say some nice religious sentiments, which don't have much correspondence to the real world. But anyway, I want his blessings for prosperity. So I'll go through all the rituals, offer some puja, water. I'll sit at his feet, you know. That's what my grandmother taught me to do. No, he understands that right now, in the presence of Angira Rishi, the king has, his ticket to get out of this mess. Let's focus, however, on the way that he's going to choose to get out of his catastrophe. It's not exactly the way that Angira Rishi would recommend, but the king is so attached. Therefore, what can Angira Rishi do? So, we're listening to the verses where Angira Rishi reciprocates with the king, reciprocates with the king's greetings. And Angira Rishi talks about the sevens. First of all, I hope your body and mind and royal associates and paraphernalia are all well. And then the first group of sevens. This is very analytical how the Bhagavatam analyzes even material happiness. Far superior than what the so-called happiness experts of today can do in positive psychology. When the seven properties of material nature, now what are those sevens? That group of seven. The total material energy, number one, the ego, number two, and the five objects of sense gratification. So that makes seven. When that group of seven are in proper order, the living entity within the material elements is happy. Angira Rishi is speaking relatively on the material platform. He's analyzing the ingredients of material happiness. Not that he endorses material happiness, but he's saying, when all this clicks, you can be happy for a moment. So what has to click? We heard the first group of seven. The total material energy, the ego, and the five objects of sense gratification. When they're in proper order. Now, how often does that happen? Think in your life when it was all working. Those magic moments when you just seemed to be at one with a universe that was just flowing in a spontaneous, pleasing way. How often does that happen? The total material energy. Your false ego and the five objects of sense gratification are all in sync. Those moments in your life you can never forget. Basically, you only see those moments in the movies. And indeed, I know of persons who, when they're having relationship problems, they complain about their partner. Saying, he's just not giving me what's in the movies. People are taking that as real. I know a fact. I know this fact. I heard it. Person saying, I want a relationship like in the movies. They're just assuming that this is the reality. How many relationships will it take for someone to realize? Movies are movies. They're actors. Actresses who have miserable lives. But when you see them on the screen, it's all working out. So people try again and again, jump from relationship to relationship, searching for the impossible dream. That's even happening in India now. Why just follow tradition? Why just do your duty? Shackling yourself to a relationship that's not stimulating, like what you see in the Bollywood films or the Hollywood films. I don't know about Australia, but I know the statistics, for example, for the USA, where they still get married in the USA. The first marriage has a 55% chance of failing. The second marriage has a 65% chance of failing. The third marriage has a 75% chance of failing. So obviously, people are struggling. These seven properties of material nature are not in order. This is Kali Yuga, remember? This is the age of frustration, dissension. No one can basically get along. You can't get along for a long period of time. Very difficult. Things are always breaking up. Relationships breaking up. Nations are breaking up. Always a problem of disunity, arguments. Still, the conditioned soul is trying to be happy in such a situation. Next group of seven. This refers particularly to the king. Angirishi explains the seven elements surrounding the king. Number one, his instructor. That means his guru. Number two, his ministers. Three, his kingdom. Four, his court. Then his treasury, his royal order, and his friends or allies. Very brilliant analysis of a material situation. Yet some people think that Vaishnavas, Krishna Bhaktas, they're happy people, but they just have no relevance to the real world. Well, let us hear your analysis of how to be happy in the material world. I heard some by Nobel Prize winning social scientists. They say, 50% of your happiness is genetic. You can't change that. 50% of your happiness is already set by your genes, and no matter what happens in your life, you always return to that genetic base. So 50% of your situation is already fixed, and then 10% of your situation is very difficult to change because there are arrangements that are pretty well fixed. You just can't drop one job and look for another immediately, especially in today's job market. So your job, where you live, if you own a house, you just can't sell it overnight and move somewhere else. Everything takes time to alter these kind of arrangements. So that's 10% of your happiness is based on arrangements that are difficult to change all of a sudden. Where you work, even who you're married to, you just can't change it all at once overnight. Your house. And then the other 40%, they say, you can influence by your attitude. You can influence your happiness by your attitude. So they say, out of 100%, you've got a 40% window to operate. Now, that 40% window, what are you going to do with that? There's no program, of course, that material academics offer for rising above material nature. There's no such thing as rising above material nature. Therefore, one Nobel Prize winner, specializing in the study of happiness, describes that people need more spiritual emotions. What does he call spiritual emotions? More gratitude, compassion, more caring. These are spiritual emotions. In other words, what should be ordinary material emotions of material existence? They're so rare in Kali Yuga that now these material emotions are exalted to the status of spiritual emotions. Gratitude. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, how spiritual you are. You said thank you. How special that is in Kali Yuga. I dropped something on the floor and you picked it up for me. Oh, you're a spiritual person. I always tell the story of how one devotee was distributing books on the street in Auckland, New Zealand, and she approached a person and me, no, I'm okay, I don't need it, I'm good, everything is fine. And I'll tell you why I'm good and why everything is fine. Number one, I don't molest children, and number two, I don't park in car parks meant for the handicapped. I'm good. That's the proof. I don't need your spiritual emotions. I have spiritual emotions because I don't do those two things. This is how low things are sunk in Kali Yuga. So the so-called spiritual emotions being advocated by mundane academics are just part of material existence. And even that material existence, they can't analyze, like a Yurishi can just do on the spot with Chitraketu. Use your life in order. Let's look at your material situation here. Of course, on Yurishi's purpose is not to give recommendations for material happiness. But this is just his opening, you know, this is intro. Just like you might say to someone, how are you doing? And just as an opening remark, and so this is Angir Rishi's introduction, his opening to discussion with Chitraketu. Obviously, Angir Rishi wants to go deeper. But at the same time, being a sadhu, he knows. We're dealing with the material world. We're dealing with a king who's up to his neck in material affairs. So how's it going? How are the material affairs going? He then asks, how are your associates? Are you listening to your associates? Are your associates offering you gifts? If that's happening, then the associates are happy. O king, are your wives, citizens, secretaries, and servants, and the merchants who sell spices and oil, are they under your control? Because king means Ishwar Bhava, as Krishna describes in the Gita. Kings had that bhava, that inner emotional makeup, to rule, to control. So it is indeed everything under control. Are you in full control of ministers, the inhabitants of your palace, your provincial governors, your sons, and your other dependents? Is this happening? And then Angirishi starts to get to the point here that he wants to make. If the king's mind is fully controlled, he asks about everything else being under control. Now he's pointing out your mind. If the king's mind is fully controlled, all his family members and governmental officers are subordinate to him. His provincial governors present taxes on time without resistance, and what to speak of lesser servants. So this is the crucial point about happiness. King, is your mind under control? Now, Angir Rishi can see the king's mind is not under control. The king is just devastated by the thought that he can't have a son. No matter how many wives he tries to conceive with, no son. So Angir Rishi is actually asking a rhetorical question that he knows the answer already, but yet, just to begin his dealings with the king, he's making his overture in this way. And then he just comes right out and says, O king, I can observe that your mind is not pleased. You seem not to have achieved your desired goal. Is this because of you yourself, or has it been caused by others? Your pale face reflects your deep anxiety. So Shukadeva Goswami explains to Bridget that Angirishi knew everything. Yet, he's inquiring from the king in this way because he wants to hear the king say it himself. Angirishi already knows, but he wants to hear it from the king because that furthers the dialogue and makes it more impactful. You may know someone has a problem, but you ask, what is your problem, by the way? And then they own up to it and they present it. And so therefore the exchange, the dialogue, can be more meaningful. So you see how expert and here is he is. He knows everything. That means he knows how to administer the medicine. And we're going to see that he doesn't try to do his job all at once. He makes some incisive points to the king. He inquires about the king's material arrangements for happiness, and then at the end of his inquiries he says, what about your mind? But he doesn't overload the king all at once. Angirishi has a program in mind for teaching the king. He knows this king is too attached to the idea of having a son. He's not ready right now to hear any transcendental knowledge. So Angirishi decides, I'll work with the situation. So next, Chitraketa responds with words of praise for Angirishi. You're full of austerity, knowledge. You're in transcendental samadhi. You're free from all karmic reactions. You're a perfect yogi. Therefore, you can understand everything that's going on in the embodied conditioned souls like us. You're aware of everything, oh great soul. Still, you're asking me, why am I full of anxiety? Therefore, let me, in response to your inquiry. In other words, the king is saying, I'm not arrogantly presenting myself and my problems. I'm not downloading on you, as they say these days. I'm not downloading on you without cause. You did ask. And because you asked, it is my duty to respond to you, because you are a great sage. So listen to Chitraketu's own analysis of his good fortune. He's taking inventory of his good fortune. And we mentioned that in the beginning today. All the things that Chitraketu had going for him. Wealth, beauty, fame, opulence, education, high birth. It's all going for him. But what is his response to all this truckload of good fortune? He says, he gives a very poetic example. If a person is afflicted by hunger and thirst, what good will it do to put flower garlands on him or sandalwood? He needs to eat, he needs to drink. Similarly, I have all these things going for me. Wealth, fame, beauty, opulence, on and on. But I have no son. Therefore, you can give me everything else in the world, but because I'm missing the son, nothing makes me happy. So, and then he adds some justification to his point that, after all, even the demigods desire a good son. So don't blame me. So he begs Angirishi, please save me from going to hell, because without a good son to perform yajnas after I'm dead, I may wind up in a hell of circumstance. You know the story in Krishna Leela, Maharaj Nirga, who just made a mistake in giving charity. He was so magnanimous he would give countless cows away to brahmanas. But by mistake, some other, a cow that he had already given to another brahmana, wandered back into his herd or something, and he gave that cow, along with thousands of others, to another brahmana. And so a whole feud developed, and he was cursed. So Chitraketu, being astute, understanding the path of karma, knows that even though he's taking all the effort to hear from his sages and be guided by his ministers, the path of karma is very dangerous and he could slip up unknowingly. Therefore, he needs a son to perform the necessary rituals after the king is dead, in case the king winds up in a hellish situation. And of course, he also wants a son, because to enjoy now. The expression is there, like father, like son. Chip off the old block. It reminds me of an old blues song where the guy is singing to his girlfriend about how he's going to make her happy when they move to the outskirts of town. There won't be anybody there always trying to bring us down. when we move to the outskirts of town. Let me tell you, baby, we're going to be as happy as we can be. I'm going to give you 7 children, and they're all going to look like me. When we move way on the outskirts of town. So that was also part of Chitra Ketu's, you know, proposition. It's not that he simply wanted a son to perform yajnas after he's dead. No, he wants to have a son now to feel that, you know, he's a progenitor, he's a procreator. He's created an heir to the throne who can carry on his vision. So, Angira Rishi, no ordinary person. He's actually born from Brahma's mind. Decided to show the king some mercy. But later you're going to find out this is not Angira Rishi's full mercy. Although the king took it in that way. Angira Rishi directed that a yajna be performed, and in this way, the wife would be able to conceive. Who was that lucky wife? Obviously, Chitra Ketu selected a wife who would receive the benefits of the yajna, and before the yajna happened, Angira Rishi gave the king a hint. Oh, great king, now you'll have a son who'll be Harsha Shoka. You'll have a son who'll be the cause of both jubilation and lamentation. And then immediately Angira Rishi left without waiting for the king's response. So this is hanging in the air. You're going to have a son who'll be the cause of both jubilation and lamentation. Gone. The sage is gone. So, you might wonder, well, what was Chitra Ketu thinking? So the Shastra describes, indeed, that Chitra Ketu was thinking, oh, I know what that means. Obviously, I'm going to be happy in jubilation when I have a son, but I'll also lament a bit because he'll be my only son. He'll be a spoiled brat, and he won't be very obedient, but that's okay. Just give me a son. So that's as far as Chitra Ketu could see the riddle that Angira Rishi gave him upon Angira Rishi's departure. Yeah, a son that's happiness and distress, okay, he'll be spoiled, he'll receive all the opulences, he'll be born with a silver spoon in his mouth, so therefore, yeah, he'll be a bit of a rat, but anyway, he's my son, I'll get a son! Now, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura points out, why did Angira Rishi say that? So, Chakravarti Thakura said, Angira Rishi was covering himself. Because he knew what's going to happen. This son was going to cause a major disaster. So he didn't want in the future that the king would blame him. Hey, what is this? You never warned me. So Angira Rishi warns him, but in a very subtle way, and then immediately disappears. So that in the future, he can always point back, I did say something, king. So the Rishis are very clever. They know how to cover their tracks. So, indeed, the favorite wife of the king becomes pregnant. Now, bear in mind that the king has quite a few other wives. So, what is the natural result of that, of the situation? The king is in ecstasy. Oh, the child is being born now. He's giving profuse charity to the brahmanas. He's so happy. He's giving out cows, gold, silver, ornaments, garments, villages, horses and elephants, and millions of cows. The Bhagavatam describes, as a cloud indiscriminately pours water on the earth, the beneficent King Chitra Ketu distributed like rainfall all desirable things to everyone. He was happy. He, as you say, he was over, he was way over the moon. After great difficulty, he received a son. So his affection for that newborn son increased day by day. And of course, just think of the mother. out of all the many wives, she was the one to have a son. What do you think is going to happen now? This doesn't look good. Of course, men, they never see what's coming. They never. At least in the USA, I know the statistics. See, when I'm in Australia, I talk about the USA. When I'm in USA, I talk about Australia. In the USA, 65% of men who are hit with a divorce are taken totally by surprise. They're totally shocked. 65%.
What happened? What?
I'm paying all the bills. I'm taking out the rubbish every morning. What's the problem? I got a big flat screen TV for the house. What? 65% of the men are totally caught off guard. You want a divorce? Why? They can't see it coming. So similarly, Chikaju, he was just in bliss with his son. He had no idea of the realities of marrying many wives. And we pointed out yesterday, he did not marry many wives just because he wanted to enjoy. He married many wives because one after another, none of them could conceive. And he felt, as a king, it's my duty to have a son, an heir to the throne, as well as someone who can perform yajnas after I'm gone, in case I go to a hellish situation. But, meanwhile, palace politics are what they are. The mother became the recipient of all the attention of the king, because she's the mother of the king's son. So, naturally, the king's affection for the wife who bore the son is going to increase exponentially. And naturally, he's going to start to neglect the other wives. The other wives, Srimati Goswami describes, had a desire to have children that became like a high fever. She has a child. Why not us? They were just... a high fever is a very torturing thing. It really absorbs your consciousness in the bodily conception of life. That's how Srimati Goswami compared their desire to have a child to a high fever. And they began to talk about how neglected they were. Oh, we might as well go to the forest. Prabhupada points out in the purport that from the ordinary viewpoint of advice, if a man doesn't have a cooperative wife at home or an appreciative mother, he might as well just head for the forest. Similarly, if a woman doesn't have nice children, she might as well just go to the forest. This is ordinary advice that we spoke about that yesterday, about Prabhupada's statement to Yadavar Prabhu, clarifying that this is ordinary stuff. It's actually not meant for the transcendentalists. So, first the wives are burning with a high fever. We don't have a child. And soon, that high fever about not having a child was going to turn into something else. They felt so neglected. And they, while feeling neglected, simultaneously they saw the wife who gave birth just receiving so much attention, prominence. It was just too much. Psychologically, it was too much. King, he didn't know it. He didn't have a clue. He just thought, a son, I've got a son. The happy days are here. My life is perfect and successful. Meanwhile, in the palace, this disaster is brewing. So, yes, first, the high fever of wanting to have a child. Secondly, that high fever became envy. They began to burn with envy. Who does she think she is? She's got what we want. Why her? Why not us? So what is the characteristic of envy? It makes you lose your intelligence. Envy is not just some innocent thing. You hate someone because they have what you want. Notice that you never become envious of someone who has worse than you. You only become envious of someone who has more than you, what you want. And a necessary component of envy is it's not simply emotional. You actually start plotting to drag the other person down. You start making schemes, subtle or gross, how to minimize that other person, how to criticize the other person, how to have the faults of that other person be publicized widely. So, Shukadev Goswami points out, as their envy increased, they lost their intelligence. Being extremely hard-hearted and unable to tolerate the king's neglect. What do you think? You would have sympathy for that? Sympathy for that? Don't understand. What did they do? They administered poison to the baby. This is real life. This is what happens. So the baby has been poisoned, and the baby is laying there dead, but his mother, I mean, Shukadev Goswami really gets into it here. He just describes the whole scene better than any movie. He said the mother is just walking within her house thinking, oh, my child is sleeping very soundly. How nice. Let the little boy sleep. Oh, my little baby. She didn't know he was dead. Then after a while she thought, okay, my little dear has slept enough. Bhagavatam describes, she's very intelligent. Manishini, very intelligent, so she's okay enough. He's rested well. I'm a good parent. I know how to raise a child. I've been waiting for so long for a child. I know the art of child raising. All right, time for him to wake up. So she sends her nurse, the maidservant. My dear friend, please bring my son here. This is life in the palace. She doesn't have to worry about the anxiety of child raising, how to clean the house and deal with the husband at the same time raise an infant. She's a queen. It's all happening at once. Everything she needs. She doesn't even herself go to wake the child. She sends her maidservant. Please wake my child. What happens when the maidservant approaches the child? She saw that his eyes were turned upward. In other words, she didn't see any signs of life. She could understand the child was dead. Immediately, the nurse cries out, now I am doomed! And she collapses on the ground. And so, of course, the mother, the queen, hears all this. She hears the loud cries of the nurse. And here he comes. What is this? What's going on? Now, she's an attentive mother. She's also a queen. She has Kshatriya abilities. She approaches her son and she sees he's dead. She also falls to the ground unconscious, her hair and dress in disarray. So the nurse is lying on the ground unconscious. Now the queen's lying on the ground unconscious. Meanwhile, all the inhabitants of the palace have heard this loud crying and they all come running and they see the scene. And they all begin to cry. The queens who administer the poison, they also come, and they start to cry too. It's life in the material world, you know. What can you do? The news gets to the king. He heard, my son has died from unknown causes. He almost became blind with grief. Have you ever been that devastated that you actually become almost blind? You can't see? This is the graphic description given in the Bhagavatam. Yeah, it's better than any movie. Shukadev Goswami describes that the king's lamentation grew like a blazing fire. Sometimes in Australia they have these bushfires. The rage out of control. What was it, 4 years ago or so, the raging bushfire in Victoria that killed 180 people, wiped out villages, no traces of the people left. The fire was so intense. So that's how the king's lamentation grew. And he was running to go see his dead child. He had heard the child's dead. He's almost blind, consumed by blazing fire lamentation. But as he's running to the site of the death, he's slipping and falling. He's so overwhelmed. He's surrounded by his ministers and other officers, surrounded by the learned brahmanas. He runs as he's slipping and falling, picking himself back up and running again. He arrives at the feet of the dead child, and he collapses on the ground unconscious. He's in total disarray. And then he regains consciousness. He's overwhelmed with grief. He can't speak. So in this way, the whole kingdom is plunged in devastating grief. The king had his wish fulfilled. He got a son. But that son is the cause of both jubilation and lamentation, just as Angira Rishi predicted. Basically, Angira Rishi is teaching the king, watch what you wish for in the material world. You may think you know what will make you happy, but you have no idea what your karma is, what your destiny is. You have no idea of the whole workings of the universe. You are like a piece of grass tossed in the river of material existence. And you, the tiny little blade of grass, are sometimes caught up with chips of wood, tree branches. These represent material conditions. So you have no control over this. Yet, although you're a tiny blade of grass in the river of material existence, you think you're independent and you can make plans for your material happiness. You don't see all the chips of wood and tree branches around you. So the king thought he knew exactly what would solve his depression, what would make him happy. He was sure. Angira Rishi knew. You actually don't know what the real platform of happiness is. You're so hung up on this material solution to your problems. You've got everything and you're still not satisfied. Don't you know that's the way of material life? When I was in Melbourne, I was having a multimedia presentation, and I was using a documentary about happiness filled with Nobel Prize-winning scientists, the world's greatest experts in the science of happiness. And so the documentary opens with footage of a rickshaw wala in Calcutta. The rickshaw wala, not the ones with motorized rickshaws, but the ones who walk, you know, what do you call them? What, their word for those ones?
The ambulance.
Huh? So anyway, they showed his little house in the slums of Calcutta, and he was explaining, my house is very nice. You see, it's open on one end with just some plastic hanging down. It's very nice for catching the breeze. How happy I am. I come home in the evening from my rickshaw work, and my little son is waiting for me at the tea stall. I know all my neighbors. How happy I am. Sometimes when I'm walking with the rickshaw, there's a sudden downpour. I get drenched, but no problem. I just start running with the rickshaw, and my clothes dry off. Life couldn't be bad. So you might think, oh, this guy, he doesn't know what real happiness is. This guy just has such a low standard, living in the slums of Calcutta, working as a rickshaw wala, living in a house that is open on one end with some makeshift plastic covering. And the guy was saying, you know, yeah, sometimes during the rainy season some leaks happen, but hey, I'm here with my family, I'm here with my friends, what is the problem? Then the social scientists pointed out something very interesting. They said, by all contemporary psychological indicators, this rickshaw wallet in the slums of Calcutta is as happy as the average American. By this psychological scientist's own parameters, own standards, there's no difference in the level of happiness. So that teaches you something about material existence. What is this illusion that is so captivating us? We think satisfaction is there. It's out there, I just have to get it. Others have it, why not me? The king was thinking, others are happy in their family life. I don't have a son, I don't do anything to have a son. And the others are thinking, look at the king, he's got education and beauty, youth, beautiful wives. What's he complaining about? This is the way of illusion. You're sure that if you just get one thing, you'll be all right. I can just have this. It's never like that. That's why a program of sense control and discipline is necessary. And of course, you know what the biggest illusion is, the biggest hoax. We won't talk about that. The whole Western civilization is built on that. You will be fulfilled in this way. Just look at the movies. Aren't they so absorbed in happiness? Without that particular illusion, there'll be no material existence. The Shastra says, Maitunya Agar, the invisible bars on the prison house of the material world. So let us analyze, where do we get this false expectation from, which leads to frustration, which leads to anger? Look at the queens, they lost all good sense. You might sympathize with them, what can you do? You know, they were neglected, they didn't have a child. This one, this wife, she is getting all the attention, she has a son, she's the king's favorite. So their envy pushed them to such a severe step. All because they felt, we'll be happier this way. If we're not satisfied because we have no son, let her also have no son. And everything will be equal. Right now everything is unequal. She has a son, we don't. She's happy, we're not. Okay, we kill her son, and then we're all in the same boat. Brilliant solution. How could you ever think like that? But when your intelligence is stolen, that's what you do. In material life, everyone can look back and see how they did something that was crazy. Motivated by passions of the moment, motivated by jealousy, envy, greed. That's the story of material life. So, Angirishi realizes, I'm dealing with an overload of expectations here, material expectations, but it's a typical overload. It's the kind of overload that is basic material existence. So Angirishi knew how to deal with the situation, and he, as we said, gave a hint to the king. You'll have a son, I promise you, but the son will be harsher shoka, jubilation and lamentation. And the king paid that little hint no mind. Oh. So now the whole capital city of the king is just plunged in an ocean of grief. Everyone is devastated. No one knows what to do. They take the well-being of the king's family as their own well-being. It's like that even today. This is not some quaint kind of old-fashioned way of behaving. If a head of state, a famous head of state, dies, everyone is grieving. If he was known to be a good leader, or charismatic leader, or in some kind of way. So similarly, the king's citizens were also caught up in the grief. So right when the grief reaches its pitch level, reaches its zenith, what happens? Angirishi comes back. Perfect timing, Sankirtan devotee. But he doesn't come back by himself. Who does he bring with him? Narada Muni. Just see how merciful Angirishi is. He is applying the best resources in the universe to help the king. So don't think that Angirishi was cold-hearted, that he allowed the king to have a son who was harsh to Shoka, jubilation lamentation. No, just see how merciful Angirishi is. He doesn't simply come back on his own. Now, first of all, he does come back. He didn't just neglect the king, I'll let him suffer. I told him, I warned him. You know, when someone tells you, I told you so, you hate that, right? All right, you told me so. What is that going to do for me, though? Generally, the person gloats. I told you so. You'll listen to me next time. Now, Angirishi came back with Narada Muni. And Angirishi just told the king point blank, you know, the first time I came to see you, I could have given you transcendental knowledge. But I saw how attached you were to having a son, and that's all you wanted to hear. Therefore, I could not deliver the full merchandise that I could have given you. I could have given you transcendental knowledge at the time, but you didn't want to hear it. Now, in your devastation, now you're ready to hear something. So then, Narada Muni and Angirishi made a whole presentation to the king to free him from his lamentation and get him on the path back home, back to God. But these are the ways of Krishna's devotees. This is the service that they do. And if we take up that mission, gradually we'll also become more expert. In the beginning, when you're a young devotee, you're presenting the right knowledge to people. But you're not so expert about how you go about being right. But the fact is, you're still presenting the right medicine, bhava aushadhi, the medicine for repeated birth and death. But as you become more mature, and how do you become more mature? By trying to be compassionate. You gradually develop better and better abilities. So that not only are you right, but you're right about the way that you're right. You become more expert in administering medicine to people who think that they are completely healthy. You do deliver the medicine. You don't water the medicine down, but you're expert at how you deliver the medicine. But that expertise is based on compassion, and it takes a while to develop. You have to start somewhere. The worst thing is if you just say, since I'm not so expert in presenting what is right, I won't say anything at all. No, you have to take the trouble to learn, to try. Angirishi and Narada Muni, they're the most expert. They have devised a situation for Chitraketu to learn. They're going to give him the mantra for going back to Godhead. He'll be assured, chant this mantra, and in 7 days you will see Lord Sankarshan. Obviously, Chitraketu was very advanced. So we want to deliver the medicine and become expert in how to appropriately deliver the medicine. It reminds me, like here in Australia, you have the Vegemite that's very famous. Sometimes I'm traveling overseas. I run into Australians, hey mate, any Govindas in the city? Some of them even ask, hey, do you know where to get Vegemite? Both things go together. I was once in Tokyo, and the center of Tokyo, it's just millions of people. And all of a sudden I hear, I'm walking there at the center of Tokyo, and I hear this voice calling out, mate, excuse me, mate. And so I turn around, and there's this guy from Australia running after me. Is there a Govindas in Tokyo? I'm sorry, there's no Govindas here. There is They already have a restaurant now, but at that time they were not. And then, of course, the conversation, you know, he said, yeah, from Brisbane, no go business, huh? But can you tell me where I can buy Vegemite? So, in the USA, there was a famous breakfast cereal called Maple. Did they ever make it to Australia? No. Maple. It was like a whole wheat breakfast cereal. And so the advert they designed for this product was about a little boy named Marky Maple who would always refuse his mother. He wouldn't take his maple. And so this was the big drama. The mother always had to figure out how her son, Marky Maple, would open his mouth and eat the maple. So, you know, this ad went on for like, this ad went on for like several years with various episodes. Each episode was, how was the mother going to get the spoon of maple into her son's mouth? So she would try so many ways. In one effort, she would have the spoon of maple. Okay, Marky, here it is. Loaded with nutrition, delicious, delectable. Are you ready, Marky? Here it is. Maple! And Marky would slam the mouth up. The next advert, the mother would try again. Okay, Marky, here it is. Loaded with nutrition, delicious, everything a young boy wants. And then she would take the spoon of maple and go around her head. Around her back. Maple! Slam his mouth shut. So, outreach is often like that. You have to figure out how to get Marky Maple to open his mouth. Eventually, the mother did figure it out. So, similarly, we want to give the medicine. We want to give the message of Param Para. That is our duty. And gradually, we want to become expert how to get the person to receive that medicine. But what's the use if we don't give the medicine? What's the point of our efforts? So we can learn a lot from Angira Rishi and Narada Muni. They did deliver the message. They told Chittaketu exactly what was going on. They explained all about how the soul is different from the body. They explained all about why are you lamenting? In which lifetime was the boy your son? Was he always your son? What about his past mothers and fathers? What about them? They went on and on with a brilliant analysis of why Chittaketu shouldn't be attached. And by their delivery of transcendental knowledge, they freed Chittaketu from material existence. They gave him the mantra, the chant, to see Lord Sankarsana. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.